This is John Shannon for Radio Free Galisteo.
I am speaking with David Correa, who is an associate professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and one of six contributors to the book Red Nation Rising, From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation. David, can you tell me a little bit about this collection? How would you describe it? It's a collection of...
Yeah, this is a project that began about 7 years ago when Nick Estes and Jennifer Dinetdale and Melanie Yazzie and myself formed the Border Town Violence Working Group in the wake of the murder of two Navajo men by vigilantes in Albuquerque in late 2014. And at the time, Jennifer Dinetdale, one of the authors of this book, was a member of the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission. She's now the chair of the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission. And they brought the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission to Albuquerque to conduct an investigation of this brutal vigilante murder of two unsheltered Navajo men on the left side of Albuquerque. And vigilante violence against the Native people on the streets of Albuquerque or Gallup or Farmington or Window Rock, Arizona, it's not unusual. It's an everyday event for Native folks, particularly those that live on the street. And while the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission was investigating the murders, Nick and Melanie and Jennifer and I went out on the streets of Albuquerque and started talking to Native folks, most of whom were unsheltered. And the stories we heard, you know, really cemented in our minds the extent of this problem related to what we're calling border town violence, which is, you know, we live in a settler society in the United States. And as we write in the book, settler societies require a really astonishing commitment to violence to sustain those societies, right? Because this is a society based on the extermination of Native people and the theft of their land. And that's not a historical event, John. That's an ongoing event that has to be renewed constantly, defended constantly. And we could see the human cost of that on the street, talking to people. And we started to go to other, what we're calling border towns in this book, white-dominated settlements ringing traditional Navajo or reservations in New Mexico or Arizona. And we started to recognize that there's a pattern here that we have to investigate further that we hadn't really seen anyone ever write about, which was there's a geography to settler violence. That sometimes takes the form of vigilante violence, like what happened in 2014 in Albuquerque when these teenagers, really, there were just three young men, none of whom all of whom were minors, who murdered, it's like sport killing, you know, just horrific,
right.
Which is not unusual. And you know, that pattern replicates itself in town after town after town. And so the geography of settler violence became something that we wanted to investigate very specifically. And so the book tries to do this, and it takes a bit of a different approach, as you sort of alluded to there with your question. It was an opening introduction which tries to establish the reason why we need to really think about settler violence as a particular kind of spatial pattern, which we call border town violence. And then the rest of the book are these sort of short essays that take up concepts or themes that we think we have to understand to really figure this pattern out. And so they're organized in different chapters. So Nick and Jennifer and Melanie and I wrote those collectively together, wrote those entries and the introductory chapter. And we had two, Radmila Cody and Benjamin Benali write the foreword to try to put that in a context for us. So the book is an attempt to really try to bring what usually is taught in schools, or if it's taught at all, it's taught as a sort of the history of Native elimination or the loss of or the theft of Native land. It happened in the past, and it's a history that we're living with today. But in our book, we're trying to demonstrate that it's not a history at all in the past, that it's lived in the present, and it's found most clearly in border towns like Albuquerque or Gallup or Farmington or Rapid City, South Dakota or Window Rock, Arizona. And what we see in places like that are what we call in the book the professionalization of vigilante violence, which often takes the form of police violence. Melanie will talk a little bit about militias and vigilante violence more in depth, but it includes police violence as well. And so those are the patterns we're trying to examine in the book. What connects all these murders and killings? How do we understand that pattern? And more importantly, how do we fight back against it? Which is really the point of the book. And I think that's probably the best summary I could provide.
In the early part of, well, during the expansion west, certainly by white settlers, you had, and this is mentioned also in a description of the book, you had military forts and trading posts, for example, circling native right. land. And of course, there still are military forts around. But my question is, have the police more or less taken the place of what the military had done in the past, which was, blatant extermination of native populations?
Yeah, it's really never been something that we could pin down on military or militia or settlers or police. This has been a pattern that is sort of a shared commitment. I mean, the history of settler colonial domination in what is today the United States has always been an obligation that every settler has to meet. So if we look at the history of what's today New Mexico, for example, that is a history in which, settlers had an individual and a collective obligation to defend the settlement against native tribes. And that took an offensive and defensive character. And if we, in particular, and I've written about this elsewhere, if you look at the 1840s, 1850s, or the sort of the borderlands, maybe what is today the New Mexico border with Mexico, the way that Apaches were defeated was by recruiting American mercenaries to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And Mexico created what they called contratos de sangre, which were these scalp contracts. And they paid mercenaries, most of whom were Americans, who otherwise were trappers for the most part and flooded into southern New Mexico, northern Mexico, and then made money by hunting Apaches and murdering Apache men, women, and children, and organized themselves in sort of quasi-militias, quasi-police forces. And this supplemented the Mexican militia, and this supplemented, in New Mexico, more formal police forces. And an argument in the book is this has never gone away. This has just taken on different form in the contemporary moment, so that police forces, particularly in border towns, the ones that you just mentioned, ring settlements. And these, by the way, were not just forts, right? They were also often called man camps. And these were commercial enterprises that focused on various resource extraction enterprises that would bring a wave of men, settlers, an area, often again ringing native settlements. And the arrival of the man camp really heralds a permanent settler presence. It often that violence then ends up focusing on native women and girls, which we write extensively about in the book. And those man camps or forts turn into villages and cities, which are the white dominated settlements we think of now when we drive around New Mexico: Albuquerque, Santa Fe, Farmington, Gallup. And the geography of settler colonialism that we map in the book is one in which every settler city in one way or another is a border town, because it's all native land. And so to understand how the border town works, how police forces operate related to native people, how militias, how vigilantes operate, requires understanding this historically, which we try to do in the book. This is a largely unknown history for the most part, and we're trying to introduce that history to folks today, because it's really impossible to confront these patterns of violence in the present moment without understanding the logic that undergirds them, the purpose they serve, and the people they target.
As you've been talking about this, and you mentioned man camps, immediately springs to mind what's going on with the petroleum industry, both here in South Dakota, in various other places where you have all these men who've come into the area and who are working. And I guess not coincidentally, you also have this rise of missing and murdered indigenous women. I believe this is the modern version.
Yes. Yeah. You could draw a straight line from the man camps that have proliferated over the last 6 or 7 year oil boom in New Mexico, both in the Gap Farmington area, but more so down in southern New Mexico. Definitely up in the sort of Bakken oil sheet field up in South Dakota, particularly, which are called, as you point out, man camps. Right, that's the same term. It's still in use. Those patterns remain the same. Both the patterns of resource extraction and the relationship of those patterns of resource extraction to violence against women and girls, and of course, then the erosion of native sovereignty. What little native sovereignty is left in those communities after hundreds and hundreds of years of settler violence continues. And, you know, we would be wrong to say that the man camps we have today look like the man camps of the 1800s or are similar to them. They're exactly the same. The patterns are precisely exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the clearest indication that what we're dealing with here is not, histories of settler colonialism, but ongoing patterns that have never gone away and, can't go away. That's the point of settler colonialism. The settler is forever insecure. Their position is never, never stable, never safe, as long as there are native people that haven't been eliminated. You know, settler colonialism is a genocidal project, and its success requires the complete elimination of native people. And the failure of the settler project to eliminate all Native then makes all Native people suspect in the eyes of settlers. They're the thing that settlers fear. And we heard that when we were on the street in Albuquerque in 2014 talking to Native people, and not all of whom were unsheltered folks, although a lot of Native people, I mean, tens of thousands in Albuquerque are unsheltered or are housing insecure. And we would talk to folks who just describe their everyday interactions, not just with police, but with, you know, what we're referring to as vigilantes, this sort of open hostility to Native people.
You're listening to David Correa, an associate professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico. He's a contributor to the book Red Nation Rising, From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation.
I've never talked to a Native person on the streets of Albuquerque who didn't tell me a cop didn't tell them to go back to the reservation. It's a common refrain, you know, the idea that they're from somewhere else and then they're bringing disorder with them to the city is what is the sort of the most frequent mode of police interaction. And yet we see that in Albuquerque. It's even more, I think, pronounced in places like Gallup, New Mexico, or Farmington, where that violence is not hidden at all. It's not a violence that's hidden to Native people in Albuquerque, but I think a lot of settlers, non-Native folks, probably are unaware of this extent of this pattern of violence. But you can't ignore it in a place like Gallup or Farmington. It's part of what the town does. It's what these towns are organized around. The exploitation of Native life, the entire economy of Gallup, for example, is organized around taking wealth from Native people and transferring it to non-Native folks, whether it's through check cashing or whether it's through high-interest predatory car loans or whether it's through the proliferation of bars and liquor stores throughout Gallup that prey on Navajo people who can't have alcohol on the Navajo reservation. So they want to drink something. If you're Navajo and you live on the Navajo reservation and you want to have a drink, you've got to do it in public in a town hostile to your presence with hundreds of police conducting hundreds of arrests every single month of Native people for doing precisely what the bars and the liquor stores are selling. So it's a pattern that, you know, we don't just see in one border town, and we don't just see in Albuquerque or Gallup, but it's replicated throughout the country, and it's part of this larger process of settler colonialism that we're trying to identify analytically very precisely in the book so that we can understand what we're fighting against and how we might best fight against it.
First step is exposing it. What are the next steps?
Well, right. I would back up a little bit. I would. It's hard to expose something that we don't quite understand. And so we really want to expose it by first detailing it as clearly and empirically as possible where it happens, who is doing it, and how they're doing it, and why they're doing it. So this is structural, institutional, colonial violence enacted through the state, often through police departments, but often through what we might call sort of quasi-state agencies or elements like militias with informal relationships to police. Vigilantes who often have license or are overlooked by police, targeting particular kinds of people in specific kinds of ways. For example, in Albuquerque, I work with a group called Abolish APD, and we are investigating the Albuquerque Police Department and the violence of the Albuquerque Police Department. One of the ways we do that is we head out on the street and to do mutual aid, and we talk to folks, and we ask them, what happened the last time you encountered a cop? And, you know, we find very few people who live on the street ever no one ever has friendly stories about that. These are not great friendly stories of their encounters with cops. But the stories Native people tell us are qualitatively different than the non-Native stories we hear. And their stories are more familiar to your viewers or your listeners who might be familiar with Freddie Gray, for example, in Baltimore in 2014, who was given a rough ride by police.
Oh, right.
Rough rides are standard sort of street justice tactic cops use when someone, say, is talking back. Or they want to give someone a punishment, but they don't want to get in trouble for doing it. So they'll throw them in the back of a paddy wagon with their legs and their arms cuffed, but they won't secure them in that paddy wagon, and then they'll just drive erratically at a fast speed, stopping short. And the person's just ricocheting around the back of the van. That killed Freddie Gray, mm-hmm. led to his death. It's a common tactic that every police department uses one way or another. But in Albuquerque, it appears to us, given our work, that it's almost exclusively used against Native people. I've talked to many. It's also usually young Native men who would tell us these stories about being just picked up off the street, thrown in the back of a squad car, often if they are inebriated or they don't have their faculties with them. Maybe they have used drugs, so they're very vulnerable. Instead of the police helping them in that instance, they punish them through these rough rides. Sometimes they'll drive them out to Isleta and just abandon them outside of Isleta. Sometimes they'll drive them out to Nine Mile Hill on the west side of Albuquerque and give them a beating and dump them in the dirt. And we've heard that a number of times from young Native men. And this is not a case of just a few bad apple cops. Mm-hmm. This is a pattern that has gone on for generations. It's replicated elsewhere. In fact, Jennifer Nez Denetdale, one of the authors of this volume, she's the current chair of the Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission. The Navajo Nation Human Rights Commission was created after the police killing of a Navajo man named Clint John in the early 2000s. He was just killed in a parking lot in, I believe it was Gallup, might have been Farmington, actually, I have to check. And there were plenty of witnesses. There were all these witnesses that saw this happen. And all of the non-Native witnesses said what the cop did was completely justified. And all of the Native witnesses said that Clint John did nothing. He had his hands up. He didn't have a weapon. The cop just assassinated him. Mm-hmm. So what explains this discrepancy of all these eyewitnesses that saw completely different things? The only difference is the Native eyewitnesses saw a man murdered, and the non-Native witnesses saw a cop do his job. And I think that's pretty revealing in that there's this, there's a kind of incommensurate relationship between settlers and the Native people whose land they're on, that they think that this world we live in is somehow one that we imagine as harmonious among different people, and we're living together harmoniously, and we just have to get along. And what a lot of, I think, non-Native folks don't realize is the world we live in right now is one constructed by enormous violence. And most of that violence, particularly where we live, and in border towns like Albuquerque and Gallup and Farmington, is a violence organized and directed against Native people almost entirely. And I'm not just talking about hearts and minds here. This isn't like a bunch of bad cops or some racist vigilantes. This is baked into all the institutions of the state, baked into law itself, so that this can be reproduced generation after generation, obscured and turned into something that looks unlike what it really is. It's not a killing machine. You know, it's tricultural harmony. It's not colonialism. It's progress. And that's what we're trying to do with the book. We can't expose that until we first really identify what is it exactly we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This can't be reformed, and it can't be redeemed. And what we're trying to do in the book is figure out a way to confront this that requires abolishing it. How do we get rid of this settler state? It's not a question that is often pursued in public policy, certainly not in public policy, not even often in scholarship. And it requires a movement. We have to build a movement to confront it, just like the movement for Black Lives has been building since the murders of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, but even before that, going back much further, James Baldwin was writing about the same exact things in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
The book is an attempt to contribute to the the continued development of a social movement that can effectively confront these patterns of violence, so that this is the last generation that's going to have to confront this pattern of genocide.
David, let me ask you this. Can you give me your final thoughts as we wind up?
You know, we were writing this book. We started writing this book, really, I would say, in 2016. This was before George Floyd, Breonna Taylor. This is before all the turmoil and violence of the last year. The thing I think it's important to point out, and we write this in the introduction, is that before Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd, he and other police killed Wayne Reyes in 2006, a Native man. You know, Chauvin didn't just kill a black man, he killed a Native man as well. Cops, we can't reform or redeem an institution that's been charged with managing the violence of settler colonialism. That's what police departments and vigilantes and militias do in a settler society. It's not about bad apple cops. It's about an institution designed to sustain this sort of horrifying killing machine. And that's what we're trying to do in the book, is just to be really clear about the stakes and what we're confronting. Public policy isn't going to resolve these problems. A few convictions and more prosecutions aren't going to solve the problem of colonial genocide. We need something more dramatic, and that's a confrontation of the settler system itself. That's not something that we can just write up in a book and explain, this is how we're going to do it. You know, vote for these people, support these policies. That's not how we do it. That's that kind of arrogance, that kind of we know the solution, just listen to us, is not the kind of work we're engaging in. We're trying to contribute to a movement that's trying to imagine a future for all of us. And we need everyone to be a part of that, not just a few elected officials who are going to tell us what's in our best interest, but rather a Native-led movement that can confront this murderous system of colonial violence in a principled way without the sort of imaginary solutions that have gotten in our way for the last five generations. So it's quite a project that we've attempted to engage in, but we got into this because of the sort of we saw the sort of murder and misery and suffering around us, and we said we've got to do something to directly confront this, and there can't be any half measures, and we're going to step on some toes, and people are going to disagree with us, so we have to be clear and explicit about it, and this is the best way we know how to do that. And I think the book ends up being a really useful guide for folks, because it's very clearly identifying the most important topics and issues that confront us. And we lay it out very clearly in the table of contents, and we provide very short, specific definitions that link to other ones that, as we say in the book, we're kind of mapping the border town so that we know where the fires of rebellion have to be set. And that's both metaphorical, but as we know from places like Minneapolis and Portland that erupt in anger and violence, against police violence, it's a real now sort of geographical fact of anti-violence work, which is that if we're not going to find justice through the law in the courts, and people are going to take justice in their own hand, we got to know exactly what should that look like, and how should we organize ourselves to keep ourselves safe and to confront the worst of this colonial system. And you know that it's hard to talk about this book to people who haven't read it, but I think if people read the book, they'll probably recognize its usefulness most in the sort of care we've taken in identifying, you know, we're sort of like metaphorically mapping the border town and letting people know how does it work, why is it so violent, and how does it reproduce its violence day after day.
And that book is Red Nation Rising, From Border Town Violence to Native Liberation. You've been listening to David Correa, an associate professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and one of the contributors to the volume. Red Nation Rising's release date is 28 April, and you can find it at its publisher's website, pmpress.org. For Radio Free Galisteo, I'm John Shannon.